Et tout de suite, sans plus attendre, on va écouter Marc Weisskopf pour discuter des effets de ces polluants atmosphériques sur le système nerveux central.
Bonjour à tous et toutes, et merci beaucoup de professeur Slama pour m'avoir invité pour venir vous parler de la pollution aérienne et les effets sur le système nerveux. Je dois, comme il a dit, vous offrir mes excuses de ne pas donner ce séminaire en français. Je n'ai pas vraiment l'habitude de parler, donner un séminaire scientifique en français. Mais donc, je vais parler en anglais, mais après, si vous voulez... Vous pouvez me poser des questions en français si vous voulez après et m'interrompre s'il y a quelque chose qui n'est pas clair. Quoi. OK. So, I will also try and speak more slowly, hopefully. I'm usually not good at that. So, air pollution effects and the nervous system. So first, and this is a little bit repetitive of the Professor Slaman, but when one thinks of air pollution and any health effects, sometimes we go immediately to places like Beijing, where we can see examples, perhaps not quite as extreme as the London fog or the other examples he gave, but that are obviously quite polluted. But it's very important to understand that that's not the only places these days we see things like that. Right here in Paris, many of you may have experienced something relatively similar to even what we sometimes see in Beijing. But as he also alluded to, and is very important, we don't just see health effects at these types of levels when you see this type of pollution. As he referenced, the epidemiological evidence also suggests that we see effects at much lower levels as well. Even on days like this, where we don't really see the pollution, but that the effects, at least long term, seem to still be there. So, as he also explained, right, the sort of first place people looked, and it's sort of at face value makes the most sense that we might expect problems of the lungs, the respiratory system, or the cardiovascular system, and a lot of evidence, as he described, has gone towards showing those kinds of effects. But as far as the brain is concerned, we have to recognize that the brain is one of the most vascularized organs of the body. It's heavily dependent on the blood supply. So anything that affects the circulatory system is most likely going to have follow-on effects in the brain. And we know for many cognitive problems or neurological effects that cardiovascular risk factors are very important for those kinds of effects. But as he also alluded to, there's more recent evidence of a perhaps more interesting route and unfortunate route of exposure to these toxicants in the air is a much more direct one through the olfactory bulb. So as you inhale particles, you know, to smell things in the environment, you have olfactory nerves that basically stick out into the environment in your nasal passages. And we understand more now about the possibility of toxicants hijacking that route to go very directly into the brain, bypassing the lungs and the circulatory system. This has been shown in animals. Günther Oberdörster has done a lot of work showing this passage. And also, as you might suspect, if this is a route of exposure, there are also effects that have been noted on olfaction itself, as one might expect if we've got toxicants affecting the olfactory nerve. So we see that, and just to note, actually, from a neurological perspective, certainly in dementias and Alzheimer's, but many neurological disorders, actually one of the first things people have noted that is a sort of early sign of these kinds of disorders is olfactory dysfunction, not being able to smell appropriately. So it sort of raises this issue as this one of the ways we're going to introduce these particles into the brain. So one of the things that first sort of started a lot of thinking about air pollution affecting the brain that kind of in some ways got the ball rolling were studies in Mexico City by Lilian Calderon Garcia Dueñas, who looked at dogs and the brains of dogs in Mexico City and also other cities, less polluted cities in Mexico, and noted on neuropathological examination of the brain many abnormal findings, ones we might not expect, things like reactive astrocytes, the sort of non-neuronal cells of the brain, degenerating neurons, presence of apolipoprotein E, which is a major risk factor for dementia, plaques and tangles, also a sort of hallmark pathology of dementia, tau-positive neurons, a variety of other things, activated microglia, vascular abnormalities, damage to the blood-brain barrier. All of these things sort of evoking the specter of neurodegeneration in these dogs. So they all are hallmarks in humans who have dementia and Alzheimer's and the things like that we find these types of issues in the brain. And so that sort of led to the first sort of real focus on the idea that perhaps air pollutants might affect the brain this way. Now, this is very broad in terms of exposure assessment, as Professor Slamo was talking about. This is simply Mexico City versus another city. So, of course, there's many differences that might be in that city. So it's not the strongest evidence that it is actually pollution, but it sort of got things going. And it's a hugely important question. You are probably all quite well aware and knowledgeable to some degree about dementia and Alzheimer's, but it's a global problem that is really growing in magnitude. So this is just a cartoon example, thanks to a former doctoral student of mine. Globally, Alzheimer's disease cases around the world, each red dot represents 100,000 Alzheimer's cases. These were the projections in 1950. And projected out in 2000, growing around the world, projected out to 2050, and this is in large part because our populations are aging around the world. But the projections are about 115 million cases of Alzheimer's disease. And I should say that Alzheimer's disease is only one type of dementia, right? So there's more dementia probably than what we're seeing here. But it's an enormous problem now. It's likely to be even more of a problem in the future. And we really don't have ways at this point of curing, certainly. We don't really have great ways of even delaying the onset of Alzheimer's, but a delay of even 1 year in the incidence of Alzheimer's would actually have a very tremendous effect on total numbers, just because of how prevalent it is. We also have, there's many trials. This is a very active area in the pharmaceutical industry of trying to find interventions or therapeutics that could delay or stop or cure dementia. And effectively, we've failed at that. Nothing has really worked to this stage. So something like air pollution, where we actually have a means of potentially intervening on a policy level, provides a possible angle to do something. If it is in fact true that air pollution or some pollutants in the air lead to an increased risk of this, it has very important consequences if we can do something about it, because it is modifiable. So those early studies, 2002, of brains of dogs in Mexico City eventually led to a lot of people like me and epidemiologists saying, well, let's try and look at this in humans in different ways. And some of the very early studies are shown here that looked at this. So it shows a range of exposure approaches along the lines of what Professor Slamo was talking about. One of the first studies was in Germany by Ranft et al. That simply looked at let me back up and quickly say that the first studies, instead of looking at dementia itself, simply looked at cognitive function in older age, a simpler thing to assess. And Ranft et al. In Germany, in a cohort there, looked simply at how close people lived to major roadways, with, as he alluded to, the idea being that the closer you are to a roadway, the more you get exposed to certain types of particles that come from traffic. Ranft et al. Found a pretty strong relation between, this is, I have it here. Do I have a pointer? There we go. A little hard to move. Further than 100 meters away from the road, getting closer down to less than 50 meters from the road, a decrease in a battery of cognitive tests that's used typically to assess sort of Alzheimer's disease cognitive problems. Joel Schwartz, that he alluded to and spoke of, and J.C. Chen, looked in the U.S. National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, a sort of population-based surveillance system in the U.S. known as NHANES, that they do some cognitive testing on. And instead of looking at how close people live to the roads, there are maps by county in the United States of different pollutants, and they, in this case, looked at ozone by county and where people lived and how that related to their scores on a series of different cognitive tests, testing memory and attention, and again found worse performance with higher ozone levels, and not unimportant ones. So for a 10 parts per billion increase in ozone, they found an effect on these cognitive function tasks that were equivalent to approximately 3 to 5 years of age, which is actually rather important. We've done some work as well, and this is work from a cohort in the Boston area known as the Normative Aging Study, where we took a different exposure modeling approach where we model the air pollutants in the air based on what's seen at monitors and the land use aspects like traffic patterns, like wind, like industry, things of that sort, to develop a map at any place in the US. And there are these maps in other places of the world, Europe as well. So we can actually estimate at a person's residence, not just the county level, what the likely pollution level is for different elements. This was black carbon, also a sort of marker of traffic pollution, and looked at their performance on the mini mental state examination score or a battery of cognitive tests, and find, sure enough, that the higher the black carbon at their residence, the worse performance on the cognitive tests. So that was just purely cognitive function, but it's important to understand what the profile of cognitive function is and how that relates to dementia, right? So cognitive performance can take a variety of sort of patterns throughout age, and in particular as we get older. And what I've just been describing are a series of studies that simply look at what we sometimes refer to as cognitive levels. So we're looking at one point in time, how do people perform on cognitive tests, and how does that relate to a past history of air pollutant exposure? And that's a place to start, but it has its problems. And the problem is that really what we care about more than actually one's cognitive performance at any point in time is how it's changing over time. And so these four lines and the different colors can illustrate sort of in a cartoon fashion, different patterns of cognitive function over time. You have somebody who rises to maybe not the highest level but stays quite constant over time versus somebody else that might get to a much higher level but declines in a very sort of up and down pattern, or the red line showing a sort of very steady declining pattern, or someone who simply doesn't rise as high and has a series of declines as we age. Pretty much everybody is going to decline somewhat, but the question is how are they going to decline? And what we really care about more than just where someone is at any point in time, which is a mix of how you got there and how you're getting out of there, is how people decline over time. And are they heading down fast? Are they heading down slowly? What's going on? And so I showed you some studies of cognitive level. There have been a series of studies that also try and look at change in cognitive function over time that are in many ways more powerful from a sort of causal inference perspective of understanding how cognitive function is changing and how that might relate to dementia. And of course, there's also the possibility that you simply cross some threshold at some point of cognitive status and you frankly enter into dementia. And that's basically that you've now declined enough that you're at this point of clinical dementia. And I will say that there is a relatively recent review on air pollution affecting these types of cognitive function by Jennifer Weave et al. In Environmental Health Perspectives, quite comprehensive across all sorts of studies. And as I say, the cognitive level, not the most strong study. Cognitive decline, there's a lot of reasonable evidence. Dementia has been less. That's been harder to study for a variety of reasons, and there's issues in how you classify somebody as being demented or not. But we have started now to do that, and in fact are working on a sort of systematic review and meta-analysis, a little like some of what Professor Slama just showed you, looking specifically at studies of air pollutants and dementia, clinical dementia defined in different ways. And there now, this is a burgeoning area of interest in public health and epidemiology. This is the studies that made it into our systematic review. You can see they're increasing relatively rapidly with up through August of last year, already more than the year before. And they cover a range of pollutants. So the most data exists currently on particulate matter, fine particulate matter that he was referring to, less than 2.5 microns in diameter, but there are studies on NO2, on NO, and ozone, and as an overall, what we are finding in this meta-analysis is that the studies that look at PM2.5, of which there are the most, we see a significant overall total effect, again, on the same sort of scale as he was talking about for cardiovascular and respiratory effects, of about a hazard ratio of 7% higher per, in this case, we simply looked at the variance in this. We didn't take a 1 or a 10 microgram per cubic meter unit. We took whatever the study was, what was the variation they were seeing, and effectively the standard deviation of that variance, and that's the effect estimate that we found. There are fewer studies for NO2, NOx, and ozone. We see the tendency for NO2 and NOx to sort of show the same kind of increased risk. Ozone, less so, but the studies are far fewer. But even with this, I want to point out that there are, well, actually, yeah, before that, I wanted to point out that one of these, anyway, is actually in France by Mortemay et al. It's a 3C study that also found it's a cohort study here in France that found an increased hazard for dementia, clinical dementia, with increased PM2.5, not so much for NO2. So we see this around the world. We got it, several studies in Europe, several studies in North America, some in Asia. They generally all show the same thing. Most importantly, though, I want to talk about how there's essentially sort of two approaches to doing these types of studies. One of them, and the one that has the most evidence for it, or most studies in it, is using what we're calling administrative data. There are things like taking advantage of US Medicare, which is the health care for people over 65 in the United States, covers the entire country, or perhaps a registry system in Sweden where you can track everybody through administrative data that's being collected for other reasons anyway. And so you can sort of identify cases of dementia based on billing or diagnostic codes using WHO, ICD, or International Classification of Diseases coding that people use to track these things. Or you can use, as he was talking about, these cohort studies where you actually, you know, enroll a group of people who don't have the disease under question, and you follow them for some time, and you track them and see how their outcomes relate to whatever the exposure may be. There are many differences from study to study, but one of the key differences in taking these two approaches is how the dementia cases are identified. So in administrative data, it's effectively a passive system. If a doctor notes that you have dementia, it will be put in the records. And we can question how good the doctor is and whether that's an appropriate diagnosis, but it's only going to be there if somebody thought you had dementia and put you in there. The cohorts take a different approach, which is they typically are seen on a routine basis, whether it's every year or 3 years or 5 years. Everybody in your group gets a test, and they sort of screen for dementia, and those that screen positive get a further workup, and you typically have a much better assessment of the outcome, and very importantly, you assess everybody. So it's an active case finding as opposed to a passive case finding. So there tends to be less error and less missingness in the outcome that you find. So I want to pause here also and take a moment to, well, actually, why did we get this one here? All right, so, right. When we see these results of some positive association between an air pollutant like PM2.5 and dementia, really the question is that we really want to know, is this causal, right? Do we think it actually has caused the disease? And the reason we want to know that is that if that is the case, we can take measures to reduce pollution by policy level changes to say, you know, you need to clean your smokestacks or something more to reduce this, right? I want to take a moment to say, and this also touches on some of the things Professor Slama was saying, that there's a very common phrase that is used that I don't, it's a true phrase, but I don't like it particularly. You may have heard of it about correlation is not causation, right? And now that is a true statement. Correlation is not causation. But it unfortunately often gets interpreted and thought to mean that everything we do in epidemiology is correlation, and therefore we don't get at causation. That is not the case. So correlation is not causation does not mean that all correlation is not causation. And a lot of what we spend our time doing as epidemiologists, as Professor Slama was talking about, different study designs, different ways we think of confounding, is to try and push the needle to allow, increase our confidence that something we're seeing may actually be causal rather than not, rather than just correlation. And so causality in this sense in our studies and how we come out of it is not, if there's one thing to take away, is that don't think of it as a black and white. It is either causal or it is not, and we have our definition. This is a scale, right? And we can be in certain places of how confident we are about whether something is causal or not. And as you alluded to, too, in the context of risk management, at some point you need to take a decision and say, is it worth actually acting given the level of confidence we have? That said, there's some very interesting aspects of air pollution studies that can raise our level of confidence that something may be causal. This is sort of a schema that he showed too about confounding. And let me say, the first thing to start out with is, we are not in an experimental laboratory, right? If we were doing something in the laboratory, we might take a target tissue and we think that effects on that tissue may affect the disease we're interested in. We apply randomly, we flip a coin, we apply a drug, or we don't apply a drug and we see what happens to the outcome. That's obviously not epidemiology. We're not in that world. We have to work with observational data. We can't, most of the time, we can't do experimental work like that. And the other thing we have a big problem with is that we usually don't have an indication of the actual pollutant we care about at the target tissue we care about. Anything we measure, particularly in environmental health, is usually some kind of proxy for that. You know, we assume that there is some effect at a target tissue that would have a health effect, and we have to measure some proxy. I have a colleague who is fond of saying that in environmental health, we measure everything badly. The question is, how badly? And I completely agree with that, and I would add to it a very important addendum, which is, how are you making a mistake? If you're getting it wrong, how are you getting it wrong? And this alludes a little bit to Professor Slama's description of Berkson bias, because we can be bad at measuring the thing we want to measure. But if we're kind of bad randomly, there's an understanding of how that affects a relation between that exposure and some health outcome. Berkson bias is actually a very particular kind that doesn't, as he say, even kind of bias the main effect of something. More commonly, there are other biases that will bias the effect that you're looking at. But if it is random, it is typically to the null. So you are less likely to say there is an association if there really is one, right? So you are making it harder for yourself if you're getting things wrong. The things we're much more concerned about are things like confounding that he talked about, where something could send an association in any direction. And you know, if we're trying to measure a target tissue dose related to an air pollutant, we might have a personal pollutant exposure. We could put a monitor on somebody's mouth, you know, backpack, monitor what's in their breathing zone over many days and relate that to other things. That's a very good, it's a relatively accurate picture of what that person is taking in. But it's got associated problems, which is that personal behaviors of that person are going to affect the level of pollutant they breathe in. Things like how they get to work, how much exercise they do, things of that sort. And if those other things are related to the outcome, we have a problem. We could get a spurious association. In air pollution studies, we don't often do that. That is incredibly labor intensive to put a monitor in someone's backpack and measure what's in their breathing zone. So we do the kinds of things he was describing and that I was showing in some of the earlier studies of cognitive function, where we develop maps or we use monitors that are around the city or around a country, and we estimate, based on where someone lives, what they are likely exposed to. And that has very important consequences for causal inference of any association you might see. The first thing that happens is, as you move further away from that personal assessment of exposure, you are doing a worse job, right? The level of pollution in Paris is an estimate of what you might be exposed to. It undoubtedly differs tremendously, actually, by each person in this room. And so the overall level in Paris is a surrogate and maybe a not great one. But there are also studies that determine how well it actually does that, right? We can look, I could actually do a very intensive monitoring of all of you. I could say, what was the Paris exposure? What was your actual exposure? How did the two relate? And have an understanding of how badly I'm doing, right? But the important part about doing something like that is that that measurement of the level in Paris, or the level at a monitor, or even at your residence, right, is a proxy for what you're actually exposed to. and it is not affected by your personal behaviors. So I can develop models that are totally independent of an individual, so that whether you smoke, what your body size is, how you get to work, is not influencing my estimate of your exposure. And for an epidemiology study, that is the most important thing, because if it's not influencing my estimate of your exposure, it cannot be accounting for any association between that exposure estimate and the outcome. So it gets around certain types of confounding. It doesn't, you know, things like time spent at work, how you get to work, time spent at home or how you get to work. It doesn't eliminate everything. You have to understand what went into building your model or what affects the levels at a certain monitor. But those are often more known and they're better understood. And if you're building a model, you know what's going into the model. So we can take account of these things. They're often things like temperature or socioeconomic factors. So it's a big advantage in these air pollution studies actually to be having this worse assessment of exposure, as long as it's not so bad that it's meaningless, right? We have to have it be reasonably good. So in the end, we do have to think of these biases and what else could be accounting for an increased risk of dementia with higher PM 2.5 exposure. And I'll say the main ones are things that he alluded to before: misclassification, getting this exposure wrong. If it's, again, the important part is, are you getting it wrong differently for the people who wound up with dementia versus the people who didn't? And when we use these overall ambient levels, it's independent of individuals, so it can't be affected by that. And it sort of removes the possibility that that misclassification is accounting for the finding. It may be making the finding smaller, because when you introduce error in a random way, unless it's Bergsonian, you tend to bias an effect estimate towards the null. So we think that's largely not accounting for these effects. Selection bias are things we need to worry about. Administrative studies, that's much less of a concern because they tend to be the entire country or entire state, depending on where it's being done. Cohort studies are a little bit more subject to this, but even there, we can understand that the issue is who gets into your cohort, who decides to join your cohort, and as you follow them, who leaves your cohort so that you don't know what happened to them. But we can also, we have ways of examining that and knowing what things tend to predict not participating or predict dropping out of a cohort. And in fact, with most toxicants, air pollution being one of them, the way these things affect being in a cohort or dropping out tend, again, to depress true associations, not create them. Ascertainment bias is another kind of bias that is actually a big problem potentially with administrative data sets. And that's the kind of thing where if you happen to be someone who goes into the medical system a lot, you may get identified as having dementia, whereas someone who just doesn't show up in the medical system as much won't, because they're not seen as much. And if the reasons you go in to get seen for other things are related to air pollution, you may be identified more often as demented if you have higher air pollution exposure simply because of that. And that is a concern that is hard to rule out with administrative studies. It is much less of a concern with the cohort studies for that fact that I said that cohort studies examine everybody on a repeated basis. And so you're really examining everyone. You're not losing someone. You're not only seeing them because they seem to be having health effects. So the fact that we actually see a stronger effect for the cohort studies gives a feeling of this is probably not driving the administrative studies, or not at least fooling us too badly, because it's probably less of an issue with the cohort studies. And then, as I said, confounding personal behaviors are very difficult to account for, but using these ambient estimates, they get to some degree taken out of the equation. So all of that together leads us in this paper to conclude that we are more confident than not, shall we say, that these pollutants are actually affecting risk of dementia. So let me also just pull back again to this idea of the direct pathway of pollutants into the brain. And note one other thing about this that is of interest is that the olfactory nerve, as it goes back into the brain, actually projects most directly to areas of the brain known as the limbic system, temporal cortex, that have a very important role in emotional well-being and emotional state and mental health. This is an area that hasn't received as much attention in environmental health, but given where this projects, and I will say, of course, all the other factors, not just the direct pathway through the olfactory nerve, but through the circulatory system, the effects on the brain can also affect these sort of emotional centers of the brain. And so the idea that we may not just be affecting cognitive function and dementia, but we might be affecting mental health is an important thing to take into consideration. This is data from the WHO on disability-adjusted life years for different disorders. And neuropsychiatric disorders are third, this was in 2010, of worldwide disability-adjusted life years, and most of the neuropsychiatric disorder burden was from mental and behavioral disorders. This is a tremendously large problem around the world. It's a rising one, so estimates in the United States now are about 26% would have had some psychiatric problem within the past year, 46% in a lifetime. This is huge, going up from 460 million in the world in 1990, estimated at 615 million in 2013. These are increasing dramatically. There hasn't been a lot of thought that environmental toxicants may play part of a role here. A clinician friend of mine, when I sort of raised this, said, boy, if you talk to clinicians, they'll all tell you the environment is related to mental health. And then they'll follow it with the environment being how your mother and father treated you when you were a kid and what your childhood circumstances were. Not that toxicants impacting the brain might be actually inducing some of these issues. But this is an area, too, where things have started to grow. This is a study that I did a while back using one of the cohorts that Professor Slema referred to, the Nurses' Health Study in the United States. We looked at over 70,000 women, estimated air pollution. In this case, it was particulate matter, yes, both of the fine type that gets more deeper into the lungs and the coarser PM10 that doesn't get as far, and found less for the PM10 but more for these fine particles that it increased the risk of scoring high on an anxiety scale that these nurses all filled out as part of their questioning. And we looked at different time periods of exposure, a broad one from 1988 to 2003, exposure in the year before they responded to this scale, or in the month before they responded to this scale. And we see significant associations with PM2.5, not PM10. Now, one point here also that's very important to realize is that exposures to things like air pollution can be correlated with themselves, right? So when we think of confounding, we usually think of something else. Do people who have high pollutant exposures have lower socioeconomic status and therefore a whole host of other issues that might be related to their outcome? We also have to be concerned that when we're looking at a particular time, maybe the last month of exposure, is that related to the last year of exposure? And with air pollution, it typically is, right? Day-to-day exposures are correlated, month-to-month exposures are correlated, year-to-year can be correlated. There are these kinds of trends. And so just looking at any one point in time, it's a little hard to say what period. So this might, maybe I feel like, okay, PM2.5 increases the risk of anxiety, but is it PM2.5 in the last month? Is it PM2.5 over the last year? What is the time period that matters? And looking at this kind of a study, where you're only looking at one time period at a time, can't really inform that, because they may be simply correlated with another period of time. We looked this very simple way to account for this kind of thing is to run models where you have both time periods in the model. So you are adjusting, it's sort of like adjusting for smoking or adjusting for BMI. We can adjust for the exposure over the last 12 years when we look at exposure over the last month. And when we do that, we actually find that it seems the relation is stronger with more recent exposure. This sort of leads to another set of inferences on causality that I won't get into, but these accounting for specific time periods of exposure is an interesting way to sort of add sort of strength to causality arguments about this. I will say this is increasing also, this idea that toxicants may affect mental health. This was a review we did a couple years ago showing, again, this is actually any toxicant, and you can see the literature on this is sort of booming over the past several years. The majority of these studies are actually air pollution studies, but there are other toxicants that get looked at as well. So getting back to sort of that question of the dogs in Mexico City, what could be happening in the brain to sort of account for some of these things? There's a lot that happens after particles come into the system. So what's displayed here is sort of different ways, right? So we have the respiratory intake here. that can lead to neuronal transport. This is the nasal pathway, olfactory bulb, getting into the brain, affecting microglial activation and different cytokines. We can get particles into systemic circulation through the respiratory, through the lungs, and transferring into the circulatory system, as was discussed. This can, by direct transport, potentially cross the blood-brain barrier, get into the brain. We can also have systemic circulating effects of those particles that release cytokines and circulating effectors in the blood system, and those then translocate into the brain to lead to actual damage to the blood-brain barrier that can have adverse consequences. Reactive astrocytes initiate processes in the brain, directly affect neurons. All sorts of things like neuroinflammation, oxidative stress, maybe protein aggregation, altered neurotransmitter levels in the brain. So there are a variety of ways that these things can influence the brain and change what's going on. Many of these, the ones I've just boxed in red, are things that we know occur in dementia, cognitive problems, psychiatric problems in the brain. They're related to those things. And so the sort of underlying biology is there to produce these kinds of effects. I want to focus for a second on the microglia. These are the resident immune cells of the brain, and they are there really to respond to insults. This is, you know, they're there to protect the brain and help clean up in a sense, right? So they're to some degree the sort of first line defense against things that are getting into the brain and having problems. And as a result of that, they will activate when something like particles get to the brain. That's their job, to try and control things. But you can get into situations where you get effectively toxic activation of the microglia, where they are sort of turned on too much and stay on beyond when they really should, and can then lead to all sorts of subsequent damage. So these particles, in theory, can activate microglia directly by the particles or other absorbed compounds on the particles or these cytokines that get in there. They have adverse effects on the neurons if they are activated too much, or also possible they get overactivated and then essentially become used up. So they don't respond as well because you've kind of forced them too much. So you can get direct effects on the neurons, but these microglia are very important in this. And one of the things that there's much more understanding of now is, so when I did my neuroscience, the dogma was that all the action in the brain was the neurons. That's what the important parts are. The microglia, the glia, the other cells were simply there as kind of the housekeepers to support the neurons. We know now that that's really not the case. That's much too simplistic. And that these glia and the microglia play a very active role in communication between neurons and therefore brain function. And one of the places that we now understand they play a much more important role is they actively change how neurons talk to each other. So two neurons connect at what's called a synapse, where they send signals from one to the other. And how those communications change is fundamental to how we learn, how we process information, how we remember things, how we recall things. And the microglia are come in, and when one of those connections has to be removed, they play an active role, and they actually sort of digest proteins and pull apart that connection. There are many reasons why we want to do that. That's a very important function to have. But if you do it incorrectly or aberrantly in some way, you can have problems, right? So this is work, by the way, by Beth Stevens and others, Beth's at Harvard, but other people have done this as well. But the point is, this raises the possibility that if you have toxic activation of the microglia and you sort of make this happen too much, you are going to basically eat up connections between neurons more than you want. And so this is one of the ideas behind cognitive decline, that you are losing the ability to connect between your neurons and actually think and remember, and that may be one of the processes. Initial synaptic loss being a sort of mild cognitive problem, but if it goes too far, you get actual dementia, you can get amyloid plaques and microgliosis that occurs. There are questions that still remain. When does activation of these microglia, when would that matter? There's also concern or interest in the idea of priming. We see effects on microglia when you're looking at people with neuropsychiatric symptoms that far precede the symptoms. So there may be things happening very early that are sort of setting the stage for how microglia act and respond to other insults and potentially leading to certain susceptibility in folks who have a certain pattern of microglial activation. So that's one of the thoughts. And so I happen to personally be interested in these microglia and what's going on in aging, and are they over eliminating synapses as part of cognitive problems. However, if we think about synapse elimination, one of the places we need to turn to is actually neurodevelopment. I said that at times synapse elimination is very important, and one of those times is as you're developing the brain. So Hummel and Wiesel in 1981 won the Nobel Prize for seminal work in how the brain effectively sets up. And what they were demonstrating in the cat visual system was that the initial work of the brain is to sort of overpopulate connections. You connect everything a lot. It's kind of like thinking of Rodin making a sculpture. You have the entire block of stone. That doesn't look like a sculpture until you come along and he actively sort of knocks away at the granite to produce the final sculpture. They basically demonstrated that that's what's happening in the brain when it's developing. They did it through manipulating what a cat sees, and they showed that in the visual cortex, initially, neurons coming from the right eye and the left eye totally overlap in the brain, and as the cat learns to see things and uses its eyes and signals come in through the eyes, those patterns split into columns in the brain where one column responds to one eye, the other eye, et cetera. And that process is driven by synapse elimination. So that is a very important process of developing the brain. It leads to interesting questions because one of the thoughts in neurodevelopmental disorders, autism in particular, is that it's a problem with over-connectivity in the brain, so not correct elimination of synapses, essentially. And so it leads to the question of, if I was talking about microglia activation by air pollutants, synapse elimination or incorrect synapse elimination, could this be playing a role in neurodevelopment? And again, this is one of the things thought of. We know that the microglia go in there, and when that correct synapse elimination is occurring, they are actually actively doing that. There's a lot of understanding now about immune molecules being critical for neurodevelopment and establishing the correct architecture of the brain. And the hypothesis is, if that is not done correctly, you get abnormal neurodevelopment to some degree. And the microglia, as I said, are central to that. It's very interesting to note that in the brains of children with autism spectrum disorders, we know that there's a very strong genetic component for autism. That's absolutely true. When we look at the gene variants that are implicated in autism, they tend to be ones that are related to that synaptic communication, that they're enriched for that problems in those kinds of genes, not problems with microglia. We don't see genetic issues with microglia in children with autism spectrum disorders. However, when we look at gene expression changes in the brain, there we see changes in children who have autism spectrum disorders in microglial genes, suggesting that the microglia, something is going on in terms of activation of microglia there. And there are people doing experiments in animals. Stacy Bilbo at Duke has done a lot of this work on different exposures like stress, maternal stress, also pollutants, affecting synapse elimination, microglia number and function, possibly being related to this kind of thing. In animal work, this is work from Deborah Corey-Slechter at Rochester, showing exposure to concentrated ambient particles in, I believe this was mice, maybe rats, I don't remember now, but that you can get pathology in the brain that has aspects that look like things we might see in autism, larger ventricles, increases of that sort, and others. This is an extreme case, but they see it sort of graded with the particles. So that, of course, led to the question of, could things like this be happening in humans with children? And I will say that, again, this advantage of being able to model air pollutants and assign exposures based on that model or ambient monitors was a huge advantage in autism-related research. There had been several studies before suggesting that toxicants might affect the risk of autism. Exposure, typically, the thought was, I assume, to the mother, affecting the development of the fetus, leading to autism. The way those studies were done were these sort of case control studies where they would get many children with autism, children without autism. They would take a blood sample or a hair sample and say, the level of metals in urine is different in children with autism than children without. That is hugely problematic because autism is a behavioral disorder. So the way an individual with autism interacts with the environment is very different. So I would expect their urinary levels or their blood levels to be different of many things, right? With the air pollution, we can totally separate our exposure estimate from any individual. So again, this is a map of PM10 levels across the United States. We can do other sorts of maps, but the idea is that map is developed and is not affected by whether any individual has autism or not. So their behavior doesn't affect the exposure estimate. That has led to a lot of work on air pollution and autism. I would say in general, this is a recent paper by Paglon et al. That did their own study and then sort of threw a bit of a meta-analysis together. And I put this up here for two reasons, at least two reasons. One is to show you that there's been a fair amount of work on this now, and there is, in fact, generally this some kind of signal that there is an increased risk of autism with higher exposure to air pollutants. But many questions remain. The other reason I wanted to show this one is this study here is actually ours in the Nurses' Health study. What these folks are showing is PM2.5 exposure during the pregnancy period and the risk of autism afterwards. While we did find this, we also found that if you look by trimester, we saw differences by trimester. So this is sort of ignoring that. This is the current study those folks did, and they saw more of a signal with NO and NO2, but they only looked at the pregnancy period. This Raz et al. 2017 is another study we did in Israel. And this that they're showing is the pregnancy exposure to NO2 and the risk of autism, which is in fact something that was in our paper. But we quite explicitly said that the problem was this was not adjusted for exposure after pregnancy, and these exposures are correlated. And in fact, when we did that, we did not see an association with NO2 during pregnancy. We saw it with NO2 after pregnancy. So I put this up here also to say, yes, there's a lot that's being done in this area, but even within this field, I sometimes beat myself up about how I feel like we're not understanding that we need to control for things when pollutants are correlated. And if we really want to know what matters when, you have to pay attention to exposures in different periods, and we're still not consistently doing that. So we're still, as I say though, overall, if I look at this literature, I believe there is something there, but we are still at the point of trying to figure out what is the something, which pollutant is the most important. And as Professor Slama referred to, it's also important to understand that PM, particulate matter, is many different things. I mean, he pointed out it's road traffic, it can be from heating, and that can differ depending on where you are. So that introduces its own complexities. But it's an important question because if we actually want to intervene on a policy level and reduce something, knowing where it's coming from is quite important. Then there's the other issues of timing and mechanism of all this. I see that I'm going over in time, so I'm going to sort of go quickly through the others. These are the two of our studies. So overall, really, right, so we're the growing evidence both in cognitive function and dementia and neurodevelopmental issues. We still don't quite understand what pollutants, particulate matter, as he talked about, ultrafines, the really small ones, quite important. Much less understanding of how we model those, and we develop larger exposure metrics for that. The other very critical issue that's still very unclear is that these things are very heterogeneous. Autism has a variety of behavioral types, and are they all responding to a pollutant like air, like PM in the same way? Cognitive profiles vary. Dementias, I mean, I've referred to dementia as one thing, but it is not one thing. And when we look in the brains of people who clinically have dementia up here at the top, we actually see pathology of many different sorts. The predominant one is Alzheimer's pathology, but you can get brains with people who are clinically defined as having dementia that show no pathology in their brain. It's a small percentage. But we also see cardiovascular effects. We see Parkinson's-like pathology. And the majority of the pathologies we see are mixed of all these things. And people without dementia also show a lot of these. A lot of them show no pathology whatsoever, but they also show some of the other pathologies. And so it's an important question to know whether any of these exposures are related to some specific pathology or a more general predisposition to this. Perhaps I tend to lean towards that latter, that it may be a more general predisposition for having a dementia, maybe in combination with other factors like genetics, for example. The other issue that's quite important is the timing. When does this matter, right? So most of the studies on air pollution and dementia are looking at air pollution in the time, a relatively short time period before either the cohort starts or the dementia is identified, maybe a year, maybe 3 years. We don't know when the critical time period is. What we do know from a lot of pathology and more biological studies is that the more we look, the earlier we see issues going on. So if this is clinical dysfunction out here in dementia, we see memory loss before that. That's mild cognitive impairment. Brain structure changes, we now know, occur even earlier than that. We can look at tau-mediated neuronal injury, amyloid deposits, well before. This keeps getting pushed earlier. So understanding when the exposure matters is very important, and we're not there yet. This is also true in neurodevelopment. As I said, we see different things when you look at different trimesters. Even week by week during pregnancy, there can be differences in effects, and we need to understand those for several reasons. It actually has causal implications that I won't go into, but it can also inform biology of what processes may be going on. If we turn to the microglia that I've been talking about, we know these develop, they seed the brain very, very early in development, and then they grow, they proliferate, and then there's sort of a die back in early adolescence again. And this is also sort of goes along with the time period of synaptic elimination that I referred to in kind of sculpting that final picture of the brain. So this sort of suggests some periods that might be particularly important in, you know, whether it's early juvenile or this later period in maybe adolescence when things are changing also could be potentially important times. And very importantly, this issue of priming, I think, could be quite important. So how you set up the microglia in your life can affect potentially what happens later when you're exposed to other things. There are parallels with this with Parkinson's disease. One of the animal models is exposure to pesticides or exposure to anything that induces inflammation, basically, in utero, that on its own produces pathology that looks a little bit, and behavior that looks a little bit like Parkinson's disease, but also actually sets up the animal, typically rats, to be more sensitive to toxins that come later, right? So you create a susceptible group if you've primed the immune system in certain ways early in exposure. And that may be by many things. It could be by air pollutant exposures very early. It could be other toxicants. It could be the microbiome, leading to a certain profile of microglial and immune responsivity that may affect later how you respond. So it might identify a susceptible group to exposures later on to things like air pollutants. And the sort of pie in the sky, really sort of too far forward thinking process here is that actually potentially opens up intervention and therapeutic opportunities. If this is true and we know that certain aspects of microglia may make you suggest you would be more responsive to this, perhaps we could intervene at the level of microglia to change that responsivity and sort of reset the system. But as I say, that's kind of pie in the sky. So with that, sorry for going a little bit too long, I'll just acknowledge the folks that really did most of the work behind at least what the work of ours that I showed you. And of course, our funders, including a gift from Jim Kristol, Biogen, and NIH in the United States. So thank you very much.